This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us today for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757, and you can dial locally at 297-5633 or send an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. We are waiting for the arrival telephonically of Dean Baquet, the executive editor of the New York Times, and he is slated to be our first guest. And, of course, he has an amazing backstory that includes time in Louisiana. Native of New Orleans, graduate of St. Aug, went to Columbia University and left there short of a degree, but won a Pulitzer Prize. And all these years later, as in 2014, when he was about to be 58 years old, he was named executive editor of the New York Times. So hopefully we will make contact with Dean Baquet, who will be the featured speaker for WRKF's third annual Founders Luncheon. It's Friday, September 22nd, 12 noon, at the Crown Plaza in Baton Rouge. And this is from a man who holds the top newsroom position in the newspaper of record, the New York Times. And Dean Baquet will discuss the current media landscape. And it is a fundraiser for WRKF's news and cultural programming, and tickets are available at WRKF.org. And as we know, the President of the United States has had a war of sorts with the media and has pointed out the New York Times as a culprit many times, but yet he has chosen the New York Times reporters to deliver important messages. He had an amazing interview a few weeks ago with three Times reporters, and that was the one in which President Trump lashed out at Attorney General Jefferson Sessions. And it is a time in which the media are under a microscope, and hopefully we will be able to discuss it with Dean Baquet today. Jeff Palermo, fine media practitioner, is in studio as we wait for Mr. Baquet. Jeff is the news director for the Louisiana Radio Network. And Jeff, I hear that we may have Dean Baquet, but sometime, or if we do have him, then sometime soon we'll talk with you about what's going on in the Louisiana world, and you've covered several governors. But before we get to him, what's your take on the most accessible governor you've covered?
You're saying John Bel Edwards is the most...
No, I'm saying, is he, or is it somebody else?
That's a good question. Well, it's not Bobby Jindal, that's for sure, especially after... Bobby Jindal was accessible during the first term, but not so much in the second term, as he was really starting to mount his run for president. Mike Foster just didn't really like talking to the media all that much, so I want to put him up there. But I would say it's close between Governor Edwards and Governor John Bel Edwards. I wasn't around to cover Governor Edwin Edwards and Kathleen Blanco. But I'll say in his first 4 years, Governor Jindal was very accessible to the media.
Well, it changed, and it didn't work for him because he tried to become president of the United States, and despite his efforts to concentrate on national media, he left the campaign, as we know, with zero delegates. But he's 46 years old, and I'm sure there'll be a second act at some point for Governor Jindal. But thanks for tap dancing with us, and we've got Dean Baquet on the line, the executive editor of the New York Times. And good morning to you from Manhattan, Dean Baquet. It's nice to hear your voice.
Hi, it's Dean Baquet. So sorry, I was late.
That's quite all right. We've got you now, and that's all that counts.
Great.
Well we wanted to, before we talk about your event with WRKF, Dean, certainly mm-hmm. this is an interesting time for media, and mm-hmm. As I look at your newspaper today, there is a story about the president's veracity, and mm-hmm. The word lie is used again, and mm-hmm. this is something that in the old days was taboo, but the headline today says many politicians lie, but Trump has elevated the art of fabrication. What do you make of the environment we're in right now?
That's a good question. I mean, we actually have used the word lie very infrequently, except sometimes I think it's just called for. I mean, sometimes you can't sort of use newspaper language to conceal and the fact that the president, and we've said this a lot, does have a tendency to exaggerate, and in a couple of instances, I don't think anybody would disagree that he's actually made stuff up. I think part of it is his shtick as a salesman. Anybody who's read about the life of Donald Trump knows that he takes pleasure in. He's a guy who sells stuff. He tells you his buildings will be taller, bigger, more expensive, fancier, and finish on time, even though in many instances he knows that not to be the case. And I think what we're finding is he's carried that same style into the White House, and I think we have to call him on it when it's very clear that something is false.
Well, he has been certainly aggressive in his assessment of the media, and in particular your organization. But before we get there, he at the same time has provided at times remarkable access.
Yeah, I think that I think two things. First off, he actually likes the media. Again, Donald Trump, the salesman, somebody who learned a lot from Roy Cohn, which he would admit himself, would say that he, in fact, believes that you prefer good press, but a lot of press is also worth a lot to you. And I think with the New York Times, he has sort of an odd relationship with us. On the one hand, you know, we've been very aggressive in covering him, as we all are with all presidents. But he's also a hometown boy. He can't help himself but talk to the New York Times. It's his paper.
Yeah. And he had a meeting with you before he took the oath of office. Shortly after he was elected, he came to your headquarters. How was that experience?
It was interesting. You know, he had called a bunch of media executives together a few days before, and we didn't participate in that. I didn't think that an off-the-record session with the President of the United States with other media executives to be scolded was a position the New York Times wanted to be in. But when he came here and met with us, he plays to his audience. It was, and the editorial board was there. And while I and the newsroom make very clear not to discuss our political views, the New York Times editorial board leans left. And he spoke to the people on the editorial board. He said the things they wanted to hear. If you were to take snippets of that conversation, if you were to read the transcript, it's of a moderate, maybe even moderate Republican, moderate Democrat. I think he just sort of played to the crowd. Look, he is a charming guy. He is very good at sort of selling himself. It was interesting. It was an interesting anthropological experience, I have to say.
One of your editorialists, and a very good one, and a Louisianian, Charles Blow, wrote that he declined to attend this event with Mr. Trump. What did you make of that?
You know, Charles is in a completely different position, and Charles is a friend, and he's from Louisiana, like me. The editorial board can say pretty much whatever they want, and they can take positions that I would never take. Charles has set himself up, and I think that's, you know, within the bounds of a good columnist, to be a constant critic and even opponent of the administration. I'm in a little bit of a different position because the newsroom of the New York Times does not want to be the leader of the opposition party to Donald Trump. Our job is to cover him aggressively, ask hard questions, and in fact, If people thought of us as and some people do, unfortunately, and they're wrong, if people thought of us as the opposition to Trump, they wouldn't take seriously some of the stories we write. I mean, I think people believe us and our stories have impact because we're aggressive, but we're straight. Charles can take a completely different stance, and he does it, you know, in a really interesting way.
Has President Trump been good for business?
Yes, he has, because news is good for business. And, you know, we usually hit, I mean, you can relate to this, we usually hit these long periods of slumps, but this is a guy who keeps making news. He's endlessly interesting. And to be honest, his attacks on us have inspired people to stand up for the newspaper. Whenever he attacks us, more people subscribe, because I think people see us, rightly, I hope, as an important journalistic institution at a time when so many institutions are being called into question. He's been great for business.
But at the same time, Dean, he calls you the failing New York Times, and every time he says that, you're saying you get more subscribers.
Yes, we do. Now, some of that is because I think we do a good job. Most of that is because we do a good job. But I think people look at that and they say, you know, look, we don't want any president to be able to belittle or hurt journalistic institutions. And we want to make sure to send a signal to the world that we want the Times to survive.
877-217-5757 is your number. And locally in Baton Rouge, it's 297-5633. The email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with New Orleanian Dean Baquet, the executive editor of the New York Times, the newspaper of record in America, and he has the top editorial position. And we'll talk with him more about what's going on in the media world and his trip to Baton Rouge. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. And if you'd like to dial us locally, it is 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Dean Baquet is our guest for a little while longer, the executive editor of the New York Times. He is a graduate of St. Aug in New Orleans, class of 1974. And I know you still come this way on occasion. And you also worked at the Times-Picayune for a while, Dean.
I did. I started at the State's Item to show how old I am, and then went to work for the Times-Picayune.
Well, growing up in New Orleans in the 70s and 80s and 90s, I guess, early 90s, that was a time when the city was adjusting, as it continues to do, but there's no place like New Orleans.
Right. No, that's right. I've lived at a lot of different places since I graduated from high school, but New Orleans remains home. And my whole family's there, so I come back often.
Well, you studied English at Columbia University. That must have been a heady moment to go from New Orleans to New York when you graduated from St. Aug.
It was. In fact, it was the first time I had ever left Louisiana, was to hop on an airplane to go to New York for my freshman year at Columbia. It was. And I spent most of my time with other friends from New Orleans, to give you an idea how shy a Southern boy I was in New York City.
And then there were a number of New Orleanians at Columbia at that time?
Oh, there were tons. There were tons. One of my college roommates is a guy named Eric Granderson, who worked in city government for a while. There's a guy named Kenneth Kanye, who's a local doctor. In Louisiana, we spent all of our time waiting for shipments of food from New Orleans.
And I noted that you, of course, have what arguably is the top role in journalism as the executive editor of the New York Times. Not far away at the Wall Street Journal, a New Orleanian, Alex Martin, is the news editor for the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, Alex was one of the best young reporters at the Times-Picayune when I was there. He covered St. Bernard Parish. The bureau chief was Jim Amos, who later became editor of the Times-Picayune. And Alex is now one of the senior-most editors at the Wall Street Journal. But there are a lot of us up here. Walter Isaacson, who used to run Time Magazine, has been up here, though he moved back to New Orleans. Nick Lemon, who was the head of Columbia's journalism school. Chris Drew, who was a reporter here who just retired to be a professor of journalism at LSU. So there was quite a Jason DeParle, who covered justice in New Orleans and now writes books and works for the New York Times. There are quite a few of us up here.
Now, you have worked in journalism, Dean, in New York, New Orleans, Chicago, Los Angeles, some of the great spots to be a reporter, but how do those cities differ in covering the news, if at all?
They differ a lot. The most intensely competitive city I've ever worked in, two cities actually, but the most intensely competitive for local news was Chicago. Chicago had two very powerful newspapers when I was a reporter for the Tribune, really powerful local television stations. This is in the late 80s. And then I was the Washington bureau chief for the New York Times. And there's nothing more competitive than Washington. At that time, every great news organization in the country had a presence in Washington. New Orleans, which I like, has a good newspaper war going between Baton Rouge, between the Advocate and the Picayune. And I think that's great. I think that's healthy for journalism, because the thing I fear the most, not to ramble on, is the decline in local news coverage. So to see a place that can support two local newspapers fighting it out, not to mention radio and television, I think it's terrific and healthy for the democracy.
What about the state of journalism right now? The New York Times, like every other organization, is facing curtailment of staff, budget issues. Is that affecting the quality of journalism?
You know, I'm not worried about people like the New York Times. I mean, I'm cutting mainly so that I can rehire and change the staff. We're roughly the same size we've always been, which is 12 to 1300. I am deeply worried about local journalism. The New York Times, the Journal, the Washington Post, the big networks, they'll be fine. You know, they'll have rough times, but you can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel. We have access to so many readers that we can keep growing. I worry about New Orleans, Birmingham, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Fresno, because the business model for local news has essentially declined substantially. And I think it's going to be really important to figure out how to keep those institutions alive, because that's just so important to the democracy, that people know what the mayors and governors are doing. And that's under threat now like never before.
Okay, I've got a few questions from listeners. One asks about the press conference on Friday with the Attorney General Jefferson Sessions, who said he was going after leakers. Is that something that is prudent?
That's troublesome. I mean, people act like people think that leaks are just you know, sort of unimportant and ways to drive subscriptions. The truth is, the greatest stories of every generation, whether it's Watergate or you know, the biggest national security stories of the age, we would not know that the United States was engaged in a drone war on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan if it was not for people who were willing to talk about that without their names used, because the government has never acknowledged it. The leaks are not just people manipulating reporters. Of course, there's some of that. But a lot of it is people who think that there are things people should know, and they can't attach their names to it because they could go to jail. This stuff is important. It would be awful for the democracy if people were prosecuted for talking to reporters.
Question about the technology. Do you see the news evolving, newspapers in particular, from traditional print to digital distribution? It's happening in some places, including New Orleans, but what about the nation as a whole?
It's inevitable. I mean, it's just inevitable. I mean, most of our readers now get the news on their phones. I think it's inevitable, and by the way, I think it's good. I know that's uncomfortable for people even of my generation to hear. I love print, but I now have a video unit. I would not have had a video unit in the era of print. I can now show things and illustrate things in such a powerful way. And as a kid growing up in New Orleans, I had access to only two newspapers, the States Item and the Times-Picayune. That same kid growing up in New Orleans could read almost any news organization in the world. So as hard as this is, and as much as it makes people nervous, it's better.
Mm-hmm. You think we'll always have a print edition of the New York Times?
I think for a long, 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 long time, there's been no evidence that evidence that it's eroding. So I think for a long time. I would never say forever, because if you'd asked me 10 years ago that more people would read us on this little telephone than anything else, I would have tried to have you committed.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But right now there's great interest and desire for print, including by me.
Me too. Another question, how should we feel about anonymous sources?
I think news organizations, including my own, sometimes overuse them. But that said, we have a story on the front page this morning about a dramatic finding by a group of climate scientists working for the government. It came from anonymous sources. we would not have been able to tell that to people without anonymous sources. We also had a story on the front page about the turmoil within the CIA over its new director. Again, that came from anonymous sources, but I think if you look at those two stories, I hope you'll agree with me, it's worth it.
Well, we're glad you're coming back this way, and certainly pleased that a local man is doing well in the biggest arena in the world for journalism, the New York Times. Thank you, Dean Baquet.
Thank you. Take care and see you all soon.
That's
be well.
Deal. September 22nd, and you can find out more about the Founders Day Luncheon by going to WRKF.org. Dean Baquet, as you can hear, quite an eloquent and passionate man about what he does, will be the featured speaker at the Crown Plaza in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And we're visiting with Alex Martin, news editor for the Wall Street Journal. Alex Martin was a graduate of Louisiana State University, 1981, and he is to be inducted in a few days in the Manship School of Mass Communication Journalism Hall of Fame. And Alex Martin, is always good to talk with you.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
Doing well. We go back a few years. We were in school together, and I actually worked for you. You're one of the first guys to ever hire me, so I owe a lot to Alex Martin. I remember those days at the Reveille quite vividly.
Well, I was thinking about that group of people just the other day with the induction ceremony coming up, and there was you, and there was Russell Carollo, who's won two Pulitzer Prizes for the Cox newspapers, and there was James O'Byrne, who's had pieces of three Pulitzer Prizes with NOLA.com, and you, who are and a statewide institution and a media entrepreneur in Louisiana, so we had a pretty good crew, and of course there was my wife.
Yes, the lovely Lisa Shelp Martin, who's a very good reporter in her own right. You also won a couple of Pulitzers. Tell us about that.
Well, I was part of a group of journalists in both cases. The first time was at Newsday in 1997. There was a plane crash in 1996 off of Long Island of a flight, TWA 800. It's the one where It was taking off from New York, headed to Paris, and a lot of the speculation centered on whether it was a terrorist-related act, and it turned out it was because they partially filled fuel tanks, and there was some abraded wiring that led to some arcing and an explosion, et cetera. So it was mechanical. And our staff at Newsday won for covering that in breaking news. That's the first 3 days of an event. And we had 50 reporters on the case, and we had every editor in the place, and I was editing most of the main stories for that period of time, but it's really the whole group is who won it. And then a couple of years ago, here at the Journal, we'd been attempting to do work about the way Medicare is abused, often by providers, not by the people who are the beneficiaries of the program, and that was the major work was done by a group of reporters, but I was the enterprise journalism editor at the time, and I had been nurturing that for a few years with people, and there's a guy named Mike Sicanolfi who ran a group of reporters who developed that story, and I was responsible for putting it on the front page and developing all the packaging, and so I had a key role in that one too, but it was, again, a group effort. And that was for investigative reporting.
Alex Martin, the news editor for the Wall Street Journal, who's a graduate of Holy Cross High School in New Orleans and Louisiana State University. And in a couple of nights, he'll be inducted appropriately and somewhat overdue to the Manship School of Mass Communication Hall of Fame. Now, Alex Martin, when you left LSU, you kind of hit the jackpot. You got a job immediately with the Times-Picayune. That's not often done, but it kind of steered the path for you.
Well, you know, Jim, actually, I worked for 2 months as the editor of the St. Francisville Democrat. I lived in a mobile home in Star Hill, Louisiana, and I was finishing up my last couple of classes at LSU, and the way I got a job at the Times-Picayune was an earlier LSU J School graduate, Mary Heffron, who was an editor at the at the Times-Picayune spotted my name in a short bio in a little newsletter the school used to send out called the LSU Journalist for folks looking for work. And she asked me to come by at a job fair at the union, LSU Union, and I did. And when I stopped by, she said, "You know, we don't just hire people from the Northeast, because they were hiring a lot of folks out of Columbia University at the time. You ought to really apply." And I thought it was a fool's errand, but hey, I mean, you know, I was making $175 a week and living in a trailer, and I thought that making $265 a week and living in my hometown might be better. And so I gave it a try, and I was lucky enough to get hired.
And you were there for how long?
I was there for 8 years. I worked in the St. Bernard Plaquemines Bureau for a while, covering St. Bernard Parish Government, and then I covered Criminal District Court in New Orleans, which quite busy, 10 sections of court, you know, always something going on. Covered the Tulane point shaving trial, was probably the most notable trial that went on during that period. And then I covered the 87 governor's race. I was assigned to Jim Brown, and who spent $3 million and didn't carry a parish, but was really interesting to cover. And then covered the 1988 presidential race up through the conventions, because the convention was in New Orleans that year, and we put a lot of people on the road. And then I did general assignment reporting until I got hired at Newsday in 1988.
Well, I remember,
and I was there for 16 years at Newsday.
One of the fine, enterprising reporters during your time in New Orleans, and I would imagine you still do that in a different realm. But one of the stories I recall, Alex, you got an exclusive interview with the guy who was the electrician who provided the sparks for the executions at Angola, and in the summer of 1987, there were eight of them in one summer. The guy's name was Sam Jones, or at least that's what he said his name was. How did you get that interview?
You know, we saw each other a lot that summer because you were working for Louisiana Network and I was covering courts and doing executions. I was at the prison and I asked about the executioner, and they said, he occasionally will talk to people, give us your card, we'll pass it on to him, and maybe he'll call you. And so I gave it to, I don't remember if it was probably an assistant warden or deputy warden at Angola. And one day I'm sitting in the newsroom at 3800 Howard Avenue in New Orleans, and phone call comes in, and it's a woman, and she says, "Hey, do you want to meet with Sam Jones?" And I said, "Sure." And they set up, and we met at a Denny's in North Baton Rouge near OK Long Hospital. I walk in, and there's a guy sitting there, and he's got a Grand Slam breakfast, and he's got this red hair slicked back and a little kit, in like kind of a duck tail kind of way, and a little kiss curl in the front. He's you could still smoke in restaurants then, and he was smoking Marlboro Lights incessantly and drinking coffee, and sat down, and I interviewed him. He had these really spooky ice blue eyes, and he was very matter of fact about it. And you know, his rationale, I mean, he was a master electrician, that's what you had to be by law, and he explained how he did it, and he was very matter of fact about the notion of why he did it, which is he believed in the death penalty, and if he thought if you believed in it, you ought to be able to, you should be able to do it. And that's what he did. And he walked me through kind of the whole very choreographed, prescribed procedures of you know, how they did what they did. And it was one of the more fascinating people I've met.
Yeah, and just matter-of-factly kills people. That's his job, and the state sanctioned it in the electric chair. That's since changed, but we still do occasionally have an execution, but not eight in a one summer as we did in 1987.
That was amazing how many there were and how often we saw each other, as I said.
Yeah. Well, I can hear the hubbub in the newsroom right now, and things are happening at the Wall Street Journal, as they usually do. But what do you think makes a good story?
Well, I think it depends, right? I mean, on a high-interest story like, say, Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Irma, there's just a great thirst for knowledge on how do I protect myself, how do I help people who've been in harm's way, that kind of thing. I think there's just an urgency that comes with that, and there could be like plenty of other stories that are that you could come up with. I mean, there's a urgency when the government's trying to decide what to do with the Affordable Care Act, right? So urgency can often be a driving factor. But then it's just like good literature. I mean, are there characters? Are there conflict? Is there, the ability to provide insight? And you know, there's lots of ways to gratify a reader. And, you know, sometimes it's through hard, straight news and finding out things other people haven't found out yet and telling people about it in a clear, concise way before anybody else. That's one way. And then another way is, as I said, using traditional nonfiction techniques of developing a character, developing a story arc, and telling just a good tale. And that can happen too. I've been involved with that. I mean, a story oftentimes progresses from something like that's urgent and breaking. So, for example, there was a big scandal during the financial crisis with this thing that used to set interest rates called the London Interbank Offer Rate. It's the base. It's called LIBOR. It's the basis for how your credit card rates and all kinds of other rates are set for consumers. And somebody was manipulating it to make money for their bank. And so we wrote about how it was manipulated. We broke the story, and then we wrote about the guy who ended up being kind of the fingered as the mastermind, this trader in London. Well, so we did all those stories. But then our reporter developed a relationship with this guy and wrote these amazing stories. We ran five stories. It was a serialized kind of tale of this guy and how he first cooperated with authorities and then stopped cooperating and then basically ended up, you know, facing 40 years in prison in Britain because of his role in this scam. And the story was just everybody who was following the story knew the end. It was a fascinating character study. And so, you know, conflict, all the things, mm-hmm. Man against man against himself, man against the environment, all those things that you learned in the eighth grade about what makes a good story can also make a good nonfiction story.
We're visiting with Alex Martin, news editor for the Wall Street Journal, soon to be inducted in the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame, and we'll be back after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and we're continuing our discussion with Alex Martin, news editor of the Wall Street Journal. In two nights, he'll be inducted in the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame. And Alex Martin has had a long career, as noted, graduated in 1981 from the Old War School just 36 years ago. And during that time, he was a reporter for 8 years with the New Orleans Times-Picayune, spent 16 years at Newsday, and now is working at one of the prestigious entities in all the world of journalism, the Wall Street Journal. I remember you being a Yankees fan when you were at LSU. I guess it was somewhat fortuitous that you ended up in New York City, Alex.
Yeah, it is. And I am still a Yankees fan, although baseball has thrown a curve at me because I used to be an Astros fan in the National League, and now they're both in the American League, and it tugs at me greatly. But I ended up moving to Long Island, New York, just outside of the main city, to work at Newsday. And one of the reasons was I had just had a great reputation, and I felt like I needed to try to have a chance to learn how to get better at my craft. I mean, I think that at some point when you're doing this kind of, when you're doing anything, it's not about just journalism. It's fun sort of when you're in a room and you feel like you're no more than most of the other people in a room, but I'd much rather be in a room where there's a lot of other people who know a lot more than me, and I can learn things and grow, and just it's kind of like the best parts about being in school when without the worst parts.
Well, you're up in a world where I'm sure many of your colleagues have degrees from these prestigious schools on the East Coast, many of them Ivy League graduates. You're an LSU guy. How is it for a guy from New Orleans, graduate of LSU, when you're working amid so many people who have had perhaps more prestigious schools in their background?
It was actually more a thing early in my career when I was in New Orleans, and they had hired so many folks from Columbia and other schools, and those folks are my friends and now, and I learned a lot from working with them, but I felt a little bit more of a need to try to prove myself there. When I got to Newsday, it was, you know, by that point I was 30 years old, and most people weren't asking that question. A little buddy of mine who ended up being my number two when I ran a group of reporters out on Long Island, he went to Penn State, and we always used to talk about being the state college guys, you know, the ag school guys. Around those folks, and you know, but by that point it was more for fun than it was for feeling it. But you know, there are occasions after moving up here where people want to make you feel like you're from someplace backward because you're not from the Northeast. And the thing I used to tell folks is, you know, the first place I lived that didn't have paid firefighters and paid ambulance corps and a sewer system was Long Island, New York.
Well, when we go back to our days at LSU together, we worked with some extremely talented people. I think people who could have worked anywhere, and some of whom have. But at the same time, some real characters. Something about this region produces people of extremely interesting proportions.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mentioned him earlier. Russell Carollo was, he was a reporter. He was older than the rest of us. He had gone to Southeastern and gotten a history degree, and then come to Baton Rouge to get a journalism degree. And he was hell bent on being an investigative reporter at the Reveille, and he did some really fine work. And but he was a hoot. I can remember he was quite a character. He'd been married and divorced, and we, you know, and remember riding in the back of his Bronco as he drove it up a levee and all kinds of other things. But he's the kind of guy who, you know, was basically hit through his career, has been basically fearless in trying to pursue stories, and has done some of the done investigations of the U.S. military and other things that have just been some of the best work I've seen. So he was particularly one person who stands out among our group. And of course there were lots of other people.
Oh, yeah.
And because the paper didn't have an advisor, the Reveille didn't have an advisor back then, we made all the decisions for good and for ill, and most of the time we made pretty good ones. Mm-hmm. And then once in a while we didn't.
Well, that's the way it works, even at the highest levels, as we've found out.
But, yes.
But the presidency of Donald John Trump, who is from Gotham City, it's the gift that keeps on giving for journalists. Every day is an adventure, isn't it?
Yeah, and at one point it was such an adventure that it was wearing out, you know, Washington bureaus and newsrooms across the country, because he was making so much news, and some of it was intended. He was intentionally making news, and some of it he was, you know, showing the difficulties that come with not having a lot of experience in a thing you're about to take over, and that's very complicated.
Well, we've come in. Go ahead.
You know, and so we, I can remember just after a long and arduous campaign, the reporters in our Washington bureau just trying to be able to stage it so they could get a little break. I mean, they were worn out.
We've noted that on election night, November 8th, you were at truly the center of the universe. President Trump and Hillary Clinton, they were literally a couple blocks apart. And my goodness, if there was ever a time when you thought, I'm here, I'm where it's happening, that must have been it.
Well, you know, I would have loved to have been at either the Javits Center where Clinton was supposed to, you know, was all ready for a victory party, complete with a glass ceiling that was supposed to be symbolic of the things she was shattering, or at the Sheraton, I think, where Trump was. I would love to have been either place. I was sitting several blocks away, and it was the most surprising election result that I had ever seen. I mean, I've seen people didn't think they were going to lose, but there was really no polling, you know, on lower level races. The only thing that was surprising was when Edwin Edwards dropped out of the runoff and Buddy Romer won in 87.
Yep.
Edwin made sure to do it after all the after he thought all the presses had rolled, and we got out a small edition of the Picayune that night. Like I said, that was probably it. This night was the only night that ever rivaled this one, and this one was way, way more surprising because just the way the polling had worked, the way the things we thought, you know, that political scientists and pundits and pollsters had thought they knew about the electorate and about the way it was moving, even with the many twists and turns that it had taken in 2016. It just, you know, we were ready for both because that's what you do. Because if you don't do it, you can't make deadlines. So we had a plan and we had stories prepared for both results. But even with that, it was a surprise.
Well, when we were in school at LSU, the journalism school was not the powerhouse it is now. But we had some remarkable professors, and one of whom I think, if we were to name the most influential in our lives, and even today, the late great Jim Featherston would have to stand out.
What a great guy, and also a really fine writer, and that's what I most valued about having Mr. Featherston as a teacher. Was he would read, and he would occasionally read some of the stories that he wrote in class. The way he was able to put together a piece was just so nice, and you know he did it on deadline, and you know he did it on a typewriter, and didn't have the ease of writing on a computer, and he was very supportive and helpful, but not a pushover, and he did other things that, you know, people laugh. You know, you talked about some of these people from elite schools. People laugh sometimes when I say, oh, yeah, we'd go in and we'd put a sheet of paper in the typewriter, and he'd say, okay, now name all 50 states according to AP style. And I still know the five of them that you don't abbreviate, the two Alaska and Hawaii, and the other three are Ohio, Maine, and Texas. Why do I know this? Because of Jim Featherston. And I can, you know, that seems like kind of not the thing you'd necessarily spend a lot of time teaching at an institution of higher learning. But, hey, it took 15 minutes one day, and I use it every day of my life. So it wasn't the worst thing. But, again, he was just so interested in his students, and he was a fun guy, and he had a lot of experience. He was, you know, he's cited in the Warren Report because he was on duty for the Dallas Times Herald that day when John F. Kennedy was shot. He had taken a woman who thought she had, I think, some pictures on of something that had, around the event, and taken her to a room in the courthouse, and she alleged that that Mr. Featherston held her hostage. It wasn't quite that. He was just being a newspaper guy trying to get the exclusive in case she had it on film, and turned out she didn't. But he shows up as a footnote in the Warren Report.
Well, Alex Martin, congratulations, and we'll see you in a couple of nights. It's a worthy honor, and it's a pleasure to see you back in your old home, on your old home turf.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Jim, and wherever I am, my heart's always in Louisiana.
Thanks for listening, and tomorrow Stephanie Regal will be in the host chair. Until Thursday, for Emily Gunn, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.